Okay, anybody have any questions before we begin? Okay? All right. Let me begin by reminding you what we're trying to do in this class. We're trying to get insight into these very central issues that define the whole field of international relations. Issues having to do with what makes for war, or conversely for a stable international system. And in conjunction with that, once we kind of get some feel for that question, that provides us with a framework for thinking about issues of policy. Are there any kind of general principles that should serve as a guideline for policy? Right? And how do we propose to get insight into those fundamental conceptual issues? By studying the history. The history, not just as one thing happening after another, a big grab bag of facts. Right? Our goal is to try and understand the logic underlying the course of events. You know, what makes one thing lead to another, and yet to another, and finally to a war or to a stable system. Because when you grasp that logic, that's tantamount to getting an understanding of this fundamental issue of how does international politics work? What are the primary factors which determine the way events run their course? And so how do you understand the logic? How do you get a sense for the logic underlying the course of events? Just by studying the history cold, just hoping that the facts will, quote, speak for themselves? Well, the facts never speak for themselves. Incidentally, that's one of the core insights from the philosophy of science, a very interesting literature in the philosophy of science developed in the late 20th century. If you ever get a chance, if you're interested in these things, you should take a look at some of these works, especially this guy N.R. Hansen wrote some very interesting books dealing with this general issue of how do you understand causation in general. Okay? And the basic point is you can't approach it cold. The facts don't speak for themselves. You have to bring a certain theory to bear in order to, it's not that the theory will provide you with answers to the question, to these fundamental questions, but it brings the questions into focus so that you could grapple with those issues meaningfully in the light of the evidence. Right? Well, in a sense, that's the kind of method I'm proposing to use today when we grapple with this question of the immediate origins of the First World War. Right? How did the war break out? What does a close study of the July crisis in 1914 tell us about some of these fundamental issues that international relations theorists are concerned with? And we're going to focus on just one very important claim that you find in the international relations literature. And this is the claim that you don't need an aggressor to start a war. Wars can kind of break out by accident, without anyone really wanting them. People are just kind of caught up in forces that they can't control and that scarcely even understand. And so you can have a war even though no one wants a war to break out. It's the system that's responsible, not the decisions of statesmen. It's the people's freedom of action is very narrowly limited by the structure of the system in which they find themselves. Again, very important themes in contemporary international relations literature. In this particular case, the whole idea that the First World War is to be understood as an accidental war, an inadvertent war, a war that was not the product of, cool political calculation on anybody's part. This was a claim that played a very important role in international relations thought in this country during the Cold War period, and in particular provided the conceptual basis for arms control. Why so much emphasis on arms control? Well, there was a certain theory of how war could begin, even though no one wants it. Obviously, nuclear age, who wants a nuclear war? Nevertheless, the threat of nuclear war was to be taken seriously. Say, why was it to be taken seriously if no one wanted it? Answer is, war can come even though no one wants it. Proof of that? Well, that's what happened in July 1914. War came during the July crisis even though no one wanted it. Right? And why did it come? Because, and here's a kind of key point, why did it come? Because of the workings of the military system that was in place at the time. It was factors of a military nature, not a political nature, a military nature that brought on this war, that overwhelmed the political process, that stampeded these statesmen who were inclined to think in political terms into taking actions that brought on a war that was in nobody's interest, right? You know, and it makes sense. You look at the futility of the First World War. You know, how can anyone have deliberately wanted this, right? See? The military system, and especially the pressure on each side to act quickly, to move before the other side had a chance to move, this incentive to go first. See, you know, this if you feel it on both sides, this could lead to a war that no one wanted. This is you know what we call the logic of preemption. The great theorist of all this stuff is named Thomas Schelling. He wrote a very famous article laying out the logic here. In its book, The Strategy of Conflict, called The Reciprocal Fear of Surprise Attack. And my view is, if any of you are seriously interested in international relations, you should definitely acquire a certain familiarity with the work of Thomas Schelling. It's a great figure, the most important figure in the history of American military thought. And in fact, along with Clausewitz, one of the two greatest figures in the history of military thought more generally. Schelling, by the way, is going to be coming to UCLA later this academic year. We don't know the exact date yet, but if you get a chance, you should go and hear him talk. He's about 90 years old, still as sharp as ever, but this will probably be your only chance to see him speak. When the date is announced, I'll let you know when and where he'll be speaking. Anyway, there's that basic notion. You can have a war even though no one wants it. Because both sides, maybe they don't want a war, but if a war is pretty much inevitable, it's better to go first than to go second. You know, taking the initiative is much better than being on the receiving end and allowing the other side to take the initiative. And if both sides feel that pressure, you can have a war even though no one wants it. Very important line of argument. And you look at the that line of argument, the role that it played in shaping especially American thinking during the Cold War period. And you say, well, what sort of evidence did they give to support it? You know, it's not enough ever when people are engaged in this kind of theorizing to simply lay out these beautiful, purely abstract arguments that people just kind of spin out of their own heads. They always want to show you, they have a huge incentive to show you that the kind of thing that they're talking about has real-world relevance. It's not just abstract theorizing, but it tells you something about the way the real world works. And so they have an incentive always to give historical examples to prove that the kind of thing they're talking about, you know, is real. And so you look at that whole literature and you're struck by the fact that there's essentially one and only one example of how a war came about because of the workings of the military system that were in place at the time. That's cited in this literature. What's that one example? The very thing we're going to be talking about today. The coming of the First World War during the July crisis in 1914, 100 years ago. Okay? And in the article that I wrote that you're reading this week, I kind of begin by quoting some of these claims. When I was trained as a historian. I was oblivious to all this stuff until I started, studying the Cold War, and I was like struck by how common these arguments were about how the First World War came, which are totally at variance with what I had been taught in my history classes when I was an undergraduate. And I'll just read some of these things. This is from Paul Bracken. You know, he's one of the theorists who wrote on these issues. The war systems of the day stimulated each other into a frenzy. Political leaders lost control of the tremendous momentum built up when their armies went on alert. Right? This is Schelling. Schelling says, there was a great starting of engines, a clutching and gearing and releasing of brakes and gathering momentum until the machines were on collision course. And Michael Harrod, famous historian, says, armies were juggernauts which even their own generals could hardly control. Right? First World War did not come about because of political decisions, because of kind of cool calculations of a political nature. They came about because the political authorities lost control. They were overwhelmed by these forces that were welling up from within the military sphere. Forces they could not control, and indeed scarcely even understood, right? That's the claim. If valid, that claim would substantiate a whole body of theorizing about how war could come even in the nuclear age, because it's the only empirical basis for that set of conclusions about how war could come. A military theory of how war could come, not political, okay? So, to try and reach an opinion of our own about how valid that theory is, the theory which emphasizes the role that military factors play in bringing on a war, follows that we need to focus on whether that particular historical interpretation of the coming of the war in 1914 is in fact accurate. All right? That's why we're looking at the history. And we're looking at it through this lens. We want to see whether the historical record, you know, supports that general theory. And to the extent possible, we want to look at the scholarly literature in this area, the literature that purports to demonstrate that the First World War was brought on by factors of a military nature, and see whether those authors make a decent case. In other words, to the extent possible, we want to let them do our work for them. We don't want to have to just kind of go into the sources and try and reach an opinion of our own. It's up to them to flesh out their arguments, their general arguments, with more detailed arguments. And then we can look at those detailed arguments in the light of the evidence. Does this mean we have to, you know, learn all these European languages and fly over to archives and, you know, do all kinds of work in order to reach a conclusion about this stuff? No. There's a method which will enable you to reach conclusions that you can have some real confidence in a limited amount of time without ever leaving the confines of the UCLA campus. And what is that method? It consists of the careful analysis of the material you find in secondary sources, so historical sources. And it turns out for the study of the origins, the immediate origins of the First World War, this is one absolutely phenomenal study. It was written by an Italian, not even a historian by training. He was a journalist and political figure named Luigi Albertini. And he worked in the interwar period. His great work was published posthumously during the Second World War itself, translated into English and published in the early 1950s in this country. Three-volume work dealing with this stuff. Two of those three enormous volumes, very well organized, focused just on the July crisis. So, you know, you look at that book, certain other books, not just reading them like a sponge in a kind of mindless way, but having these specific questions in mind, whether the claims the various scholars have made are borne out by the evidence. And because the book is so well organized with each chapter divided up into sections, each section having a clear focus. You can zero in on exactly what you need in order to answer these questions. So the analysis I'm going to take you through is kind of an example of the sort of analysis you can do, the kind of method that I outlined in the very first class for getting insight into these fundamental issues of international relations theory. The key thing is you want to first identify the kind of core arguments and then look at the kind of key claims that are used to support them. And the key evidence is used to support those key claims. In other words, you want to get a feel for the architecture of arguments, for the structure of these arguments. Because once you do that, once you see how the big issues turn on relatively narrow questions, right? And those narrow questions are more studyable than these big abstract issues, right? What that means is by studying these narrow questions, you're going to get insight into these big issues. We'll see how this works. And I put in schematic form the structure of the argument that we're going to be analyzing here on the blackboard here. Okay. Yeah. At the most general level, you have this theory: war can begin by accident. You don't need a political decision to start a war. It's all right. Wars can be inadvertent. People just stumble into them. Very important conclusion. And that very general theory is based on claims about one particular way in which war can begin by accident, namely through the workings of the military system that are in place at the time. You know, war can begin by accident in all kinds of different ways, you know, much more political in nature. But this theory stresses the role of military factors. What is the support for that theory? Go down yet another level of abstraction, a particular interpretation of how war came in July 1914. First World War, it is said, came about because of these factors of a military nature. All right? And then we go down yet another level of generality, and we look at the specific arguments that these people make, not that I'm making, but that people who argue along these lines make when they're fleshing out these claims. Because they identify three distinct factors, three distinct pathways in which all of this military stuff can bring on a war that nobody wants. And what are those three distinct pathways? Where's this article about the argument about the rigidity of military plans? The rigid war plans, you know, they couldn't be changed. People were just locked into these war plans. They had one and only one way of going to war. And the fact that these plans were rigid, that had a lot to do with the coming of the war in 1914. You find this argument a lot. And then the second argument is the cult of the offensive argument. I think I mentioned to you, maybe it was in the last class, that Robert Jervis article about the security dilemma. I think I was telling you about the security dilemma. That Jervis article is like one of the most important articles in international relations theory to be, you know, written since the last 50 years or so. And it was written in this very building, by the way, when Jervis was an assistant professor in her own department. The basic argument here is that countries are trapped by the system. They're trapped by the structure of the system in which they find themselves. They're virtually forced to behave in certain cases as aggressors, to adopt offensive policies and take the initiative in starting wars and so on, even if their goals are purely defensive in nature. They would have been very happy to just, you know, sit on their hands and accept things as they were if they had a guarantee that everyone else would behave likewise. They may be kind of quite happy with the status quo, but they might be forced for purely defensive reasons to go on the attack because they have no guarantee that other countries are going to respect the status quo in the future. Right? And And so it's a very nice theoretical superstructure that explains why it can be that you could have a war even among status quo-oriented, essentially defensive powers. They're forced by the logic of the system to behave aggressively. This is a very important line of arguments taken up by the most prominent international relations theorists of the present and the recent past, people like John Mearsheimer. He has this famous book called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. This is what's tragic about it. You have war even in a world where people would be happy to accept things as they are if they had the guarantee that everyone else would accept things as they are. But Kenneth Waltz, most famous, most prominent international relations theorist of the late 20th century, making much the same argument, right? But Jervis took it a step further. He says, well, this whole security dilemma dynamic, what determines how severe it is, how sharp it is, how pernicious it is? And his answer was, how much emphasis you place on offense as opposed to defense. Because in a world where people believe that offense has the upper hand and that just for the sake of securing your own position, you have to go on the offensive because you can't fight a war in a purely defensive way. It just, if people believe that just won't work, well, then that leads to much greater instability than if you had a defense-dominant world. And those insights were taken up by a number of other scholars. They're often called the defensive realists. First and foremost, Stephen Van Evero, also people like Jack Snyder. I don't know if these names mean anything to you. Leading international relations theorists today. And Van Evero especially, he takes this argument that the crucial factor, the key factor that determines how serious a problem this is, how seriously we should take this whole problem, accidental war, inadvertent war, and so on, is whether people believe that the offense has the upper hand. How much emphasis do the militaries at the time put on offense as opposed to defense when they're coming up with their doctrines, right? And so he makes a number of arguments along those lines. It's clear that the world, the military world, the strategic environment of Europe in 1914 was a world in which all of these militaries, even the militaries of small countries like Belgium, place an enormous emphasis on offensive military action. You couldn't just sit on your hands. You had to go on the offensive. Right? And the claim is this had an awful lot to do with the coming of the war. And then there's the third key argument that's made. And this is the argument about interacting mobilizations. This whole this mobilization system that existed at the time, this created a huge amount of instability, because once one country mobilized, the next country's going to have to mobilize, and the next country's going to have to mobilize, and you just can't sit on your hands with this stuff. And for Germany in particular, mobilization meant war, because the Germans couldn't just allow Russia to complete her mobilization, because it would make military action against Russia very difficult. The Germans needed to take advantage of the superior efficiency with which they could mobilize. Mobilization means, these armies composed of huge numbers of reservists. The reservists are called to the colors, and Germans could do that much more quickly. Russia does it much more slowly, and so if Germany is going to have any chance of winning, Germany is going to have to act before Russia completed her mobilization. So basically, this mobilization system, it created all kinds of instability, because once say Russia mobilized, Germany would not have to counter-mobilize, but indeed start a war, and this created all kinds of. So you look in the literature, and those are the three main arguments that are used to support the theory that the War of 1914 came about because of the workings of the military system, And the 1914 case is the main case supporting these more general ideas about how war can come, ideas which, as I say, have enormous political importance. So we've unpacked it to a certain degree. And it makes the analysis of the issue much more viable. You know, it's like you can get a handle on these questions because you have unpacked it. We know these specific things that they're saying about the rigidity of the war plans, about the cult of the offensive, about the interacting mobilizations. Specific arguments, right? And those specific claims provide us with a lens that we can look through that's going to bring the evidence into focus. We know what the questions are that we have in mind. You know, are these three specific claims valid? And we look at evidence that's going to help us answer those specific questions. And if we can answer the questions about those three mechanisms, it's going to tell us something very general about how war came in 1914, about how war can war come by accident, essentially inadvertently, the inadvertent war theory in general. See, it's much easier to study these specifics than it is to just kind of grapple with the issue on a very general level. Okay? So that's how you set it up. See how you unpack it and you let these guys do your work for you. And you look at the specific arguments that they make to support their more general claims. And you want to examine those specific arguments, those three specific arguments, using two criteria, the test of evidence and the test of logic. And I'm going to show you how this kind of works. We'll start with this rigidity of military plans business. I'm going to give you an important example of someone making this kind of argument. This is Barbara Tuchman. She was a popular historian. She wrote a book called The Guns of August. Came out in 1962. Played an important role, this book, in the thinking of the Kennan administration at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, Kennedy was very careful to make sure that Cuban Missile Crisis didn't bring on a Third World War the same way the July Crisis had led to the First World War, in large part because he read this book. And I'm going to read you a key passage. It's the concluding paragraph from her introduction. Remember what I said about first and last paragraphs, introductions and conclusions and so on? It just says, "War pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. It was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move, lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of staff, who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate, attempted to back away, but the pull of military schedules dragged them forward." Right? Very, you know, dramatic, right? Well, what's the test? I said two tests: test of evidence, test of logic. First, the test of evidence. When you look at these arguments about the rigidity of war plans, people couldn't change the war plans, you know, the pull of military schedules was dragging them forward. No one could change any of this. One story is told over and over again in the literature. This is what people call the August 1st misunderstanding. You know, the crisis is building up, and it seems that the storm in all its fury is about to break. When the German government receives a telegram from its ambassador in London saying that the British might very well stay out of the war if the Germans agree to fight the war just in the east and stay on the defensive in the west. Right? Now, the German army had this one and only one military plan. It's called the Schlieffen Plan. General Schlieffen was the head of the Prussian General Staff. not in 1914, but about a decade earlier, and he came up with this basic plan for how a two-front war could be fought. And the basic idea of the plan was to take advantage of the fact that Germany mobilized a whole lot more quickly and more efficiently than Russia. Right? And I should say, everyone in this class should understand the logic of the situation created by the Schlieffen Plan, because I'm going to ask you about it in the midterm exam. Okay, so that should get your attention. All right. The fact that Germany could mobilize so much more quickly meant that Germany had a kind of window of opportunity at the very beginning of the war. She could leave her eastern border relatively unguarded during the initial phase of the war, after the Germans had mobilized, but before the Russians had really completed their mobilization, because Russia was mobilizing so much more slowly. The Germans didn't have to worry about Russia right away. And they could take advantage of that by concentrating all their forces, basically, in the west, throw them against France by marching through Belgium. Belgium was a neutral country, neutrality guaranteed by the power since 1839. Okay. Defeat the French army, you know, one-on-one, knock France out of the war, and then still have time to then pivot around, redeploy her forces to the east, and deal with Russia after France was knocked down, right? That's the only way the Germans felt that they could win win the war, because a long war of attrition, the Germans couldn't win. And you just look at the map, you can see why the Germans felt that they would be outgunned in a long war of attrition. Because there's Germany just kind of packed into the heart of Europe, and she was going to have to face these three great world empires, you know, with control of the seas, you know, all these overseas colonies, access to the resources of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Germany had to move fast. Incidentally, you see the same dynamic in Russian policy during the Cold War, Israeli policy in dealing with the Arabs. It's a structural sort of thing. Doesn't mean the Germans are more evil than anyone else. Their strategy is, to a certain extent, shaped by the nature of the situation in which they find themselves. Okay. Yes?
The catalyst for Germany acting is they felt that, with their one plans, they felt that Russia was indeed mobilizing, and that was driving their need to act faster?
German policy was that as soon as Russia mobilized, Germany would have to mobilize. Right.
We'll come
to that. Okay. This is the German strategy. They're going to fight the war in the West first. Now the British tell them, "We'll stay out of the war, and we'll even keep France neutral, maybe, if you agree to stay on the defensive in the West and fight the war only in the East." Okay. A complete violation of the basic principles of the Schlieffen Plan. And according to the standard story, General von Moltke, who is the head of the Prussian General Staff at the time, when he sees that the Kaiser and the Chancellor are in favor of accepting this British offer, he says, "Your Majesty, it cannot be done. We have this one and only one plan. We have to fight the war in the West. We can't just change it at the last minute like this." Right? And the standard count is the Kaiser had no answer for this and gave way. Right? I mean, it turned out that the German ambassador had kind of either misunderstood the British offer or the British changed their mind, so it was never a real possibility the British would stay out of the war like that. But still, the argument is you could see how this rigid war plan locked the Germans into a strategy that might not even make political sense. Okay, wonderful story. Great story. You see it in all these different accounts. The problem is that it turns out not to be true. And as a matter of fact, if you read the Tuckman book with any care, you would see she tells the story accurately, because this is what happened. Yes, they received this information from London, the Kaiser and the Chancellor. You know, basically, their attitude is break out the champagne. Well, we won't fight the war in the West. We'll stand on the defensive in the West, and we'll fight the war in the East. And it's true that Moltke said, Your Majesty, it can't be done. But instead of the Kaiser giving way, it was the Kaiser just said, well, we're just going to do it anyway. And he turned to his aide-de-camp and said, give orders to the troops in the field that they're not to violate Belgian neutrality. We're going to stay on the defensive in the West. You know, Moltke refused to even communicate this order directly. And in Moltke's own memoirs, published in 1917, he said, I thought my heart would break. I went home and cried tears of despair. Right? It was only after the Kaiser was informed that no, the British offer, there was no real British offer, that he basically turned to the military and says, okay, well then, go ahead and do what you want. Right? Now this is really important, because this is the one key piece of evidence, the kind of smoking gun sort of evidence is cited to support this theory. You see? We're looking at something very narrow, a particular story of something that happened during the crisis, how that story played a key role in supporting the rigidity of war plans argument, and that's one of the key arguments supporting this general theory of how war came in 1914 and how war can come more generally. Right? You see the power of the method. You unpack things. You look at the concrete evidence that's used to support these general claims. If it doesn't stand up, well, then that tells you something. But you can't just leave it there. You also want to kind of take a look at the logic. Test of logic. And here it's basically you do a thought experiment. Saying, what if the war plans had been more flexible? What if the Germans had more options for themselves? What if they had decided to fight the war in the East, and not in the West? If they had that option of fighting the war in the East, standing on the defensive in the West, what difference would those more flexible war plans have made? Well, if you believe it was a source of weakness for Germany because it inhibited her political freedom of action to have an inferior war plan and to limit herself to just one and only one way of fighting the war, well, that would be a source of weakness for Germany, and a source of weakness should lead, in principle, to a more moderate policy. If the Germans had more flexibility, the Germans would have been in a stronger position and could have pursued a more intransigent policy during the crisis. So when you think of it in those terms, why should the rigid war plans have had the kind of effect that's attributed to them? All right? On the other hand, if you think that the policy of fighting the war in the West was better than the fighting the war in the East, then flexibility wouldn't have made any difference anyway. So why should the existence of one and only one plan have had the kind of effect that it's attributed to? I should say just in passing that you can see that in scholarly interpretation there's a certain psychological phenomenon at work here. I mean, have any of you been exposed to Tversky and Kahneman, cognitive psychology, the whole heuristics and biases thing, taking Debbie Larson's course, for example? There's some very interesting work that was done, especially by Tversky and Kahneman, about kind of certain patterned forms of non-rational behavior, kind of cognitive shortcuts, don't quite make sense. One of them is what they call the representativeness heuristic. This is the idea that you see things that are similar in certain ways, and you assume there's a causal connection between them. Right? You see, if something is bad in one area, you assume that it's kind of causally related to bad things in another area. Look how bad Stalin was at home. All the millions of Soviet citizens he killed. That must mean that he pursued an aggressive policy vis-à-vis the United States in the Cold War. You find those kind of arguments a lot, and in this case. It's like, well, rigidity is bad. Obviously, flexibility is good. Rigidity is bad. War is bad. So one bad thing, there must be some sort of connection one and the other. But that's just a cognitive bias that we have. When you think about it more closely, you see that how little there is to it. Okay? Next, the cult of the offensive business. This is kind of an interesting argument. What Vannevar does is he kind of looks at a whole series of phenomena that he views as rooted in the great emphasis that's placed on offensive military action. And in particular, the German war plan, the Schlieffen plan, he views in that context, right? This is a highly offense-oriented plan, right? It's Germany can't just sit on her hands, but Germany has to take action, move militarily against France at the very beginning of the war. Right? The problem with this plan, according to Vannevar, is that it creates a very large window of opportunity. You know, this term window of opportunity means if war breaks out now, we still have a good chance of winning. But if we sit on our hands and wait just a few years, then victory is going to be out of the question, and we will be defeated. Right? So the window of opportunity yawns very large in an offense-dominant world, whereas if the Germans had said, we could just sit on our hands and pursue, just defend our own borders, well, then the change in the military balance is by no means that significant. There's no great pressure on the Germans to move now rather than wait till later, right? And sure enough, you could find a lot of evidence showing that the Germans think along those lines. But here, once again, you gotta, you know, start asking these very basic questions. Yeah, it may have been to Germany's interest to have a war now rather than later, and that might have pushed the Germans toward a more intransigent line during the crisis than they otherwise would have taken. That's not the only effect of that sort of shift in the military balance. If Germany is strong now, it's going to be weak later, then the Entente should have seen that same thing. The Entente, Britain, France, and Russia, should therefore have had a greater incentive to put off the showdown, to be more conciliatory in 1914, and if war was inevitable, to fight it at a point where they had more of a strategic advantage. And those two effects should cancel each other out. They should be a wash. Okay? Moreover, again, you do this thought experiment. You try and think, how would things have worked in a defense-dominant world? Offense-dominant world means, yeah, maybe if war breaks out now, we can actually achieve total victory over the other side. But we also run the risk of total defeat. There's that downside which would not exist in a defense-dominant world to anything like that same extent. Right? That concern about the risk of total defeat, you know, it can't be that both sides have an irrational world can rationally think that they're going to win easily. Right? There's obviously going to be a risk of defeat, for total defeat, for one or the other in this kind of world. That risk of total defeat should hold both sides back, you'd think. And you compare it with what we know about how international politics works in a situation that where the defense clearly does have the upper hand. And by that I have in mind Anglo-Russian relations in the course of the 19th century. Britain, with her naval power, can't hope to inflict a total defeat on Russia. And Russia, with her land power, can't hope to inflict total defeat on Britain. And yet you look at the policies that were pursued by both sides during the period of the Crimean War and in the Eastern Crisis in the late 1870s, and you're astonished by how willing both sides were to risk war in an almost frivolous way. Because the downside risks are so limited for both of them. And that's an aspect of the whole problem that is not taken into account. And this is this whole the generic problem here goes by the label of cherry picking. People have a kind of pet theory, and they will see evidence that's in line with their pet theory and ignore evidence and dynamics that run counter to it. Okay? So we can rule these two things out. And that leaves us with the third pathway, the interacting mobilizations. And really, this is the heart of this whole line of argument. Yes. Was there a whole system where one mobilization led to another mobilization and led to war? Yes, this was the system established by the Schlieffen Plan for the reasons I outlined. The Germans had to move before Russia had completed her mobilization. So then, as soon as Russia gave the order to mobilize, and these things can't be hidden, you know, because it's an entire society that's being called up. As soon as Russia gave the order to mobilize, the clock starts ticking. The Germans can't sit on their hands. They have to move against France. Mobilize first, attack France through Belgium, and then with the hope of knocking France out of the war before they had to deal with Russia on their east. So a Russian mobilization does lead to a German mobilization, and for Germany, mobilization means war. So Russian mobilization basically makes war inevitable. But is that tantamount to saying that the mobilization system was a cause of the war? It's like a pistol. You know, you pull the trigger of a pistol and it leads to someone being killed. Is the whole electrochemical or mechanical mechanism that leads from the pulling of the trigger to the release of the bullet to its penetration into the flesh of the victim? Is that the real cause of the killing? It's like, no, provided the shooter knows what the effect is going to be. If everyone knows what the effect of the first mobilization is going to be, right? And if the people responsible for that decision are free agents and are making this for political reasons, not because they are stampeded into it by pressures welling up from within the military sphere, then you can't say it's an accidental war. It's just the first phase of a general war. This is how a general war starts, same way as the crossing of borders or the attack on enemy forces is the first phase of the war and not the cause of the war. All right? And again, this allows us to unpack the argument. If everyone understood that mobilization would lead to war automatically, and if the people who made the decision to mobilize were making it because they felt that the time had come to go to war, and they were not making it because they were stampeded into it by the military slamming its fist on the table a la Tuchman, then you can't say that this is a cause of the war. So for it to be a cause of the war, you need one or the other of those two things to be false. You know, either the Germans didn't, or the Europeans in general, the people who made these decisions, especially the Russians, didn't know what the consequences of mobilization were. Maybe they thought mobilization would just have a deterrent effect. Or they were not free agents and they were kind of stampeded into it. So we've unpacked it and we can look at those two sub-arguments. When the Bolsheviks took over in Petrograd in 1917, they went through the Tsarist archives and they released all kinds of important evidence relating to this subject, and it's including the records of the key meetings at which the Russians made the decision to order general mobilization. And it's very clear from those records the Russians knew exactly what they were doing, right? On the whole second point, were they stampeded? Once again, say, no, it's not a case of both sides feeling pressure to move first, a la Thomas Schelling, you know. The Germans, who are the most militaristic power in Europe, they had a deliberate strategy of not being the first ones to mobilize. You know, if the war was going to happen, Russia would be the first one to mobilize because that's the only way they could portray the war to their own people as essentially defensive. Right? You look at the evidence, it doesn't support either theory, either the ignorance theory or the stampeding theory. So you've gone through all of this stuff. You've looked at all of these arguments. You see how it affects this more general interpretation of how war came in 1914. You've already established the importance of that general interpretation in supporting this general theory of how war can come. And you've reached, by use of this method, some very important conclusions, right? That the inadvertent war theory doesn't hold water, right? A negative point. It's just one of the many things you do when you're trying to get some understanding of how war can come, but it's very important to be able to do that sort of analysis, because even its limited analysis has important, far-reaching implications. Okay, I'm out of time now. Next time, we'll continue with the war itself.